My name is Fitz Nolan. I'm a third-year graduate student at Yale. I work with Brian Ford, and we're in the DDIS group there. And this is also work with our colleague, Romke. And I'm pretty excited to talk to you today about nonlinear compression, which we feel is a pretty new and novel approach to what has been around for many, many years, regular compression. So what is regular compression? Regular compression is what we're calling linear compression. And what we mean by that is we mean that it takes blocks of data and some initial compression state, and it compresses that and modifies the compression state linearly. So you take block one and state zero, and then you compress. You produce compressed block one, and you produce state one. State one is then used to compress block two. So what we see is that any block depends on all previous blocks to acquire that compression state used in compressing it. So if you look at S2, S2 depends on producing S1, which depends on S0. So we observe that this dependency chain is restrictive. When you want to decompress your data, you have to go in the same order as compression. So you can't decompress compressed block C2 until you have S1. You can't have S1 until you've decompressed compressed block C1. So this really prohibits random access. If you want to decompress a particular data block, you can't do it individually. You have to decompress everything that came before. So in summary, we say that compression state is transformed linearly. And this is pretty much independent of any compression algorithm. So for the rest of this talk, I'm going to use this single gray diamond to denote a data block, the compressor, and the compressed block, because this talk is mostly about compression state. So, you know, for space reasons and for clarity on the slides, this single gray block up here is going to denote a data block coming in and a compressed block going out. And we'll really focus on the states. Okay, so this is the outline of the talk. We just talked about linear compression. Now I'm going to talk about how we use linear compression in storage systems. After that, we're going to present nonlinear compression. We'll talk about some example applications for NLC, our prototype implementation, as well as the challenges that we're still facing, the future work, which is certainly significant, as we'll see. So let's take a look at compression in storage systems. As Phil pointed out, most compression in storage systems is one of two forms, or a combination of the both. It's either taking a data source, breaking it into blocks, and compressing those blocks, or you take the data blocks and you look for similarities and you delta encode. This is the same techniques that we see in many different storage systems, be it deduplicating file systems, distributed source control management, or even collaborative editing systems like Google Wave. In particular, for distributed source control management and collaborative editing, what we have are small updates. We have small deltas on the order of a kilobyte or less of data that's changed. Maybe this file has only changed a little bit. So it's important to remember that we're really talking about small block sizes here. Okay, so when we have these data blocks coming in, there's really two characteristics that we've identified for these data blocks. Either the data blocks are related or they're not. So either you have many data blocks all coming from the same source, and so they're all pretty much similar in content. The application would think that they're all related. Or you have some unrelated blocks. Maybe you have a file in one folder of a deduplicating file system that's very different from a file in another folder or directory of a deduplicating file system. So you have data, the inter-block content is either related or not. Second characteristic is availability. When does this data become available? Is it all available at once, or is it available over time? If you have a huge data file, that all comes at once maybe. But in the case of distributed source control, maybe you have these versions of the file becoming available over weeks, months, years. So linear compression is pretty well suited for two of these cases. If you have related data that comes all at once, go ahead and linearly compress it. Just zip right through it. Because the application's probably not going to need one of those blocks without needing all of them. So it makes sense. Conversely, if you have unrelated data that comes over time, do linear compression on that too. Because you're not really going to need, in theory, you're not going to need some of this data in relation to other blocks. You're going to need it as its own entity. So go ahead and linearly compress the block of data that you get, and then use another linear compressor on the next block that you get. But there are two cases that we feel linear compression is really not that well suited for. So let's take a look at these individually. First, if you have unrelated data that arrives at once, like I said before, what you're really looking for is random access. You'd like to be able to get at some of that data without having to decompress all of the other data. It's not related. The application doesn't care about that other data in this particular case. So you can do random access with linear compression. The way to do that is resetting your compression state between blocks. So to be concrete, let's imagine you're using Huffman compression here. Resetting your compression state between blocks is throwing out that Huffman tree after each block you've compressed, going back to zero with your compression state. So this graph shows what happens when you do that with the popular compression algorithms today. You can see that this gives you random access because you can now decompress any particular block just by starting at zero and decompressing it. But it's going to kill your compression ratio for small blocks. So the next scenario that we feel like linear compression is not well suited for is related data that comes over time. What you really would like to do is reuse your compression state. You don't want to start from zero because you have related data. You're not going to really need this particular block by itself. You're probably going to want it with the related data that came before it. So you'd like to reuse your compression. You'd like to reuse that Huffman tree. And while there's a notion of seeding your compression state or setting a compression dictionary to start, there's really no general abstraction for doing this, for using a long-lived compression state. So, in summary, we basically say that linear compression forces this all-or-nothing trade-off between compression ratio and random access. Furthermore, there's really no notion of copying or reusing compression state over a long period of time. So let's keep those two cases in mind now as we present nonlinear compression. So linear compression has initialize, compress, and decompress. Pretty simple API. It's been around for a while. Nonlinear compression is just a superset of that. You can do everything that you can do with linear compression with nonlinear compression. We're only making two modifications to the API, two additions. The first is we're adding fork. Fork takes a compression state node, and it copies the state node into a new compression state node. So it duplicates the compression state. So now you can use these two compression states independently. So let's take a concrete example here for version control. How would you use NLC fork? Let's imagine we have a file, foo.c, and we have version 1 of that file, and that version has been compressed already, so we've acquired some compression state. Alice and Bob are going to collaborate on this file now. Alice is going to make a small change to the file. She's going to add some code. But notice that there's a content dependency between what she adds and what already exists. Similarly, Bob is going to make an addition to the file. There's the same content dependency. His change really only makes sense in light of version 1. But note, too, that his change is independent of Alice's change. So we want them to be able to work independently, compress, and add to the history of this file independently. So this is the state node graph that we're using to represent fork. So S0 is the base compression state. We see that gray diamond implying the first version of the file coming in, and that produces S1. S1 has the compression state built up after compressing version 1 of foo.c. Now we fork that compression state out to 2a and 2b. Alice and Bob use the compression state independently. They make changes, they compress with it, and they get the benefits of the compression state that was built up from compressing version 1. Okay, the next addition, merge. Merge takes two state nodes, two compression states, and merges it into one. So we'll get into a little bit more how exactly this is done and sort of the challenges with it. But for right now, just imagine that you have two independent state nodes, two Huffman trees, and you combine them into one. So why would you want to do that? Well, let's go back to our example. Let's say that Alice and Bob each added a function, a separate function, a distinct function, into their versions. Now we'd like to merge their functions in. They're going to be added to the history of this file, and people are going to continue to use these functions in the future. So it's important to note that them adding their functions, compressing the compression of their functions that are added, isn't really so important. Because when we create version 3, it's probably just a pointer back to version 2, version 2a, version 2b. But future versions of this file, version 4, 5, and 6, would like to be able to use compression state built up from the first time that we compressed Funk Alice and Funk Bob. So here's our compression state node graph that we have for merge. Merge takes 2A, 2B, sorry, takes 3A and 3B, which is the result of compressing Alice and Bob's independent contributions. And it produces S3. That's it. So that's the addition we're making to the compression API, fork and merge. Because what you can do now with as an application is you can explicitly state and you can decide where the dependencies are in your data, as opposed to saying that any given block N always depends on N minus 1 all the way back to 1. The application can now say block N depends on this block, this block, and this block. And it can express that through this simple API of fork and merge. So here's a few details about our architecture. We provide a single module to the operating system. It's a single abstraction, so the application keeps these state nodes around and it passes them back and forth through our module to compress and decompress, fork and merge. It's also important to note that NLC is independent of any particular compression algorithm that we're used to today. Within a block, you still use traditional linear compressors. So you're still going to use LZW, you're still going to use LZ77, you're still going to use Huffman coding, arithmetic coding, whatever. It doesn't matter. Inside of a block, it's still traditional linear compression. It's just that between the blocks, NLC gives you this extra ability, this added capability. So the application can use this fork and merge strategy. We think some natural applications, and we'll get into some example applications, but some natural idea is to fork off and create logical streams within your data and use these state nodes to compress data that's related and then merge to synchronize. And then currently the application is keeping the compressor and decompressor in sync by making sure that it passes these state nodes to the NLC module in the right order. In the future, though, we'd like to look into an idea of naming or identification of state nodes. Okay, so let's take a look at some example applications. The first one that everybody kind of thinks of when they see this is parallel compression. Yes, now I can fork off three children and I can compress in parallel. I see 3x speed up. And while you can do that, that's only one of the gains that you really get with NLC. So this works. You have independent compression between these three streams. And that's fine, but you can pretty much already do that with gzip. You know, you could make three gzip instances and compress independently. So something a little more interesting is along the lines of the file version control, what we have with synchronized streams, where you want to go off and you want to compress independently two streams of related content over a period of time, and then you'd like to merge them together as some checkpoint mechanism. Maybe you'd like to chuck out old compression state and start again, but you'd like to keep around some of it. And that's where we get into merge. And we'll talk about merge a little bit more in the future work and talk about ways that you can do merge and ways you can be intelligent about that. So this is synchronized streams. We think this is pretty logical when you have, this makes sense when you have logical streams that are not, maybe that are similar to themselves, but maybe aren't related to the entire data stream that you have. The last application is what we're calling windowed compression. And that's where you would fork off three children and compress three blocks independently. And then you merge the resulting state from the first block into what we're calling a cumulative state. Now you fork S4 from the cumulative state and compress a block. But note here that S4 only depends on the resulting state from S1 and S0. It's independent of S2 and S3. So if you had the compressed block from S4, you could decompress it with only having the modified state S1 prime. You don't need S2 or S3 at all to decompress the block 4. So then when you want to do 5, you merge in S2 prime, and you fork off S5, and you compress. Again, note that 5 only depends on 1 and 2, not on 3 and 4. So what we have here is we have a window of independence. So that the oldest W blocks, where W is the window size, are all needed to decompress a given block. But the given block is independent of any block that is within W states in the past. So this is pretty interesting, especially for network transfer. So what have we built? We've built an adaptive Huffman compressor in C++ at this point. So it's not it's not meant to go head-to-head with GZIP, which uses Huffman and LZ77. And it's not really meant to go head-to-head with mature, optimized compression programs. It's an order of magnitude slower at this point, and as you can imagine, fork and merge are very expensive. Duplicating memory overhead is tough, as well as merging is tough, too. Furthermore, as your block sizes get smaller, if you duplicate compression state, the ratio gets larger. So you're using more memory just to compress the same amount of data that you were already compressing before. But the nice thing about merge is that eventually you can use all of your compression state. So what we see in the case of Huffman coding is that if you'd like to approach the optimal, you need to at some point use all of your compression state that you've acquired over time. You can't just toss out some of it because you may not reach the optimal. So here's a graph. It's got a lot going on, so we'll go through it slowly. But this shows taking 128 byte blocks and compressing them with different compression schemes. So the blue line shows normal linear compression. It takes 128 bytes, compresses, and then it moves to the next block. So it builds up compression state sequentially. So that's really the optimal line in this case for compression ratio using Huffman coding. The red and the green are NLC approaches. The red is simple parallel. That's the first NLC application I talked about. And that is where you fork off three children, W children, and W is three in this case. So you fork off three children, and you compress blocks independently. The green line is the windowed compressor that I just talked about. So that merges in older compression state, W states in the past. So you can see that the green line learns a little bit better than the red line because it can take advantage of older compression state that the parallel compressor is ignoring and not using at all, doesn't have access to. But what's more important about this graph is that the cost for that window of independence is really paid for in the first 10 kilobytes of the stream. So after that point, in the case of Huffman coding for this source, which is just an English text source, you approach the optimal. So you're getting the optimal compression, but you still have the ability to decompress a block of data without having the previous couple blocks, in this case, the previous two. So now let's talk about future work. We have a lot of work ahead of us. And first and foremost is the merge. A lot of people ask us about the merge. Is it really needed? Is it necessary? At this point, our belief is that it is necessary. It's necessary to use merge because you can learn from all the compression state that you've seen. If you don't use merge, you will not learn from all compression state. Secondly, we also feel that merge is useful as a synchronization point. When you have the compressor and when you have two independent compressors, it may be useful to have them synchronize, especially if you have some kind of heuristic or agreed-upon method for merging where you can toss out old or unuseful compression state. And that really may be the way to do merge, is through heuristics, is through saying, okay, let's not look at all the compression state that we've built up in this entire tree. Let's look at maybe the most recent, or let's look at the most frequently used. And so there are definitely heuristics that we can explore to make merge both worthwhile and not prohibitive due to its cost. But fork and merge are going to be expensive because they're expensive operations. Duplicating memory overhead is expensive. So maybe we should instead, we're wondering whether we should instead advertise fork and merge as something that should be used sparingly as opposed to on a, you know, each block basis. So that's something that, again, future work will tell us at this point. And then I've mentioned before that as the block size decreases, the memory overhead ratio increases. So that's something that may be prohibitive in some applications. Lastly, the notion of naming or identification. And this is one that we feel like is pretty interesting for the future, and that's the idea of having the NLC module keep track of these state nodes and the streams in particular in the data source automatically for the application. So the application doesn't really need to keep track of which state nodes depend on previous state nodes and which state nodes should be used for forking and merging. It would be nice if the application could have something a little higher level to express and say, I would like these streams to be related, and I would like these streams to be independent. Make that happen for me. So that's work that we're planning to pursue in the future. So this project is in the very early stages. We have a lot of future work ahead of us, but we believe that with NLC, we have a more powerful abstraction than we have with normal, popular, traditional, common linear compression. We thank a lot of people, in particular Jana, Avi, Michael, and Rob Ross, as well as the anonymous reviewers. And I thank you guys all for your attention, and I'm very happy to take questions at this time.
Okay.
Frank Barris, Exablocks.
Am I at the right distance? Is that good? Okay. So have you given any thoughts about how this would cooperate with a garbage collection system where basically what you depend on to do your compression might be the blocks there, the candidates for removal, and over time more and more of that could accumulate?
Yeah, so that's actually a great question, and we think with Merge, that really can help the NLC module identify which candidates are best for garbage collection. Because with Merge, you can say, okay, I've taken care of this state. Nobody else can do anything with this previous state because I've got all of the useful state from this previous compression state node. So go ahead and free that compression state node because we don't need it any longer. We've merged it.
Okay, fair enough.
Hi, Grant Wallace, EMC. How big is the state that you're keeping?
It really depends on the compression algorithm. So for Huffman coding, it's frequency counts. So if you have a 256-byte char array, you can keep frequency counts for each of the appearances of these bytes, and you can build your Huffman tree from that. In the case of LZW dictionaries, you're keeping strings around. So that's much larger. That's an order of magnitude large. That can be anywhere from 10 kilobytes up to a megabyte, depending on how long-lived your stream is. So that's very costly in the memory overhead for LZW.
Okay, and another question is, does a compressed block refer to a previous block somewhere else in the file system, or does it only refer to the state?
A compressed block refers to compressed data. The state node is something separate.
But to decompress a block, do you have to refer to some other block?
To decompress a block at this point, it's up to the application to know which blocks came before it. So which state nodes it needs to...
Okay, so there's some referential checking, just as in the Delta system,
yeah,
to make sure that you don't delete or clean a block that was used to compress this block.
You have a dependency chain.
Okay,
exactly.
So a compressed block has a pointer to some other block.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
Michael Condit, NetApp. This seems like fascinating work, but it seems it imposes more burden on the programmer than is maybe necessary. I want to ask you a question so I understand it. If you have two files, a file A and file A primed, and A primed differs only in a few bytes, but they're at the very beginning of the file, would you have to do a fork in the state at the beginning, and then you would not, even though the rest of the files are identical, they would not be sharing compression state?
Well, that could be an issue of block size. If you take your block size very small, if you sort of know that the differences are only going to be affecting certain sections of the file, maybe you could change your block size. Instead of saying the block size is going to be 4 kilobytes, let's work on 1 kilobyte blocks. And then you can keep the other 3 kilobytes around so that you're only compressing the 1 kilobyte twice.
Well, let me just plant an idea in your head for a different way of looking at this that doesn't impose any API on the compression programmer.
Okay.
Why not just view it as, at least for dictionary-based schemes, you have a dictionary that was generated by producing file A.
Mm-hmm.
Just allow file A prime to use all of that dictionary, which contains the strings, the repeated strings that throughout file A, and even though A prime has a difference at the very beginning, it would still benefit from the entire dictionary of A.
That's kind of what we're saying with fork.
That is what you're saying.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like you can only share the compression state of blocks that come before you in the file. Maybe I misunderstood.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand your question
but we
could talk offline.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
Thanks. Thank you.